4 or grade 5 because they're too far from any other educational building anywhere close by. And so there are numbers of them that only go to the 4th grade or to the 5th grade, and then that's the extent of their educational opportunities.
So we're finishing up with Wilson Shirk and Kathy Norris of St. Mary's Amazing Mission Group. You're on your way to your 14th trip to the Dominican Republic. When do you leave, Wilson?
One group leaves on Saturday, the 5th of January, and the second group leaves on Monday, the 7th of January. So we stagger it a bit so that not all of us are going at the same time. As of today, there are 24 people going on Mission 14.
Thank you both for sharing this amazing experience with us and for bringing kindness and thankfulness to our community and to the people of the Dominican Republic. So thanks for listening, everyone. This is WGTD 91.1 HD Education Matters. Thank you and have a great day.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Lenaya Quinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, and Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist at the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Laura Sumner Kuhn. I'm your host for today's Community Matters. Thank you for joining us today when I'm welcoming my guest, Gabriella Parra, who is an attorney and a partner with the law firm of Lade and Parra in Milwaukee. Gabriella graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School with honors and is the daughter of Mexican immigrant parents. She and her law partner, Kevin Lade, represent a number of people in the Racine and Kenosha communities who are immigrants to this country, and we thought she could shed some light on our situation with immigration here. So welcome, Gabriella.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to the program.
Well, we're happy to have you here, and maybe you can clarify some things for us. Our program this morning is actually airing just after we have celebrated Thanksgiving, and that's kind of an interesting tie to immigration. Thanksgiving immigrants, we celebrate immigrants who came to this country in the 1600s in Jamestown or Yorktown in Plymouth, and actually were struggling for survival when the Native Americans were helping them out. And we just celebrated that fact this last week. But I think oftentimes in the celebration, we lose fact that they were indeed immigrants who came to this country where there weren't any laws restricting immigrations for nearly 200 years after that. And then even those laws were very brief and didn't really have many restrictions on new people coming into this country. And in fact, immigration law became a little more noticeable and profound in 1924 or so, after the biggest wave this country has ever seen of people came to the United States and made it what we know it now. So much has happened in that last 100 years since that time. Could you tell me a little bit, Gabriella, about what faces a person who wishes to come to this country? We've heard about President Trump saying, oh, people are welcome here if they come here legally. But what does that really mean in terms of money and time and sponsorship? And what is the process these days?
Of course, yeah. So I think that one of the things that came out over the last year was something called chain migration. And what people don't understand is that if you have no family in the U.S., then it's very hard for you to come enter the U.S. lawfully through a family petition. So you're either doing a family petition or you're doing what's called a business immigration And for the family petition side of things, if you have, for example, a parent that wants to sponsor their kids and the parent is a lawful permanent resident, that whole process can take up to 2 to 3 years before the child comes into the U.S. If you're a U.S. citizen and want to sponsor a sibling, for example, that's going to take 20 years before you see your sibling coming into the U.S. or a visa becoming available for them. So it's not as easy as people make it seem, or as fast as they're making it seem. It takes a lot of time, a lot of years in some petitions. And there's only certain categories, so it can only be for U.S. citizens. They can only sponsor their parents, spouses, or children. For lawful permanent residents, which are the individuals that got their green card, they can only sponsor spouses, minor children, for the wait to only be 2 to 3 years once the child is over 21, as well as for a U.S. citizen, if it's a child over 21, the process can take sometimes up to 10 years before the child can come in. And so if they have their own families back in their home country, then once the child comes in, they would have to sponsor their family, and that adds up more time processing in the case. So, I mean, like I said, for a sibling petition, it can take up to 20 years before you see your brother or sister coming into the U.S.
Goodness, that can take more than a third of a lifetime in some cases. And yet it sounds so simple just to say that. I'm sure there is much that drives somebody to seek, either through asylum or by travel here, to settle in the United States. In all of the cases that you and your law partner are handling in our area, what can you tell us about the people who have sought to come here? What had brought them here to this country, and what kinds of issues do they face now as immigrants?
Yes. So, I mean, a lot of the people that are in Wisconsin, they're here because there's job opportunities, there's job openings, there's a high demand, and, you know, the people that are already living in the community are not meeting that demand. So, you know, all of my clients that I've represented, they all came here, the vast majority, because there were job opportunities. And then there's also some that were escaping the violence that was happening in their home country and then settled here in Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha area. But that's a lot of them, that's their number one reason. I mean, there's so much poverty in their home country. A lot of them are from Mexico. I would say the vast majority of my clients that are from Racine, Kenosha, even Milwaukee, are from Mexico. And there's just a lot of poverty, a lot of the violence that's happening with the criminal organized groups. And so that's why they came here and settled here. A lot of the community in Racine, Kenosha are long-term residents. So it's not someone that just came here last year. I would say the vast majority of my clients from that area have been residents of Racine and Kenosha for more than 10 years. They've lived here. Their children have gone to schools here. They've made a life here. So it's not, you don't really see a lot of the recent immigrants that you hear about it right now with the refugee making themselves to the border. You rarely see a lot of the asylum seekers make it all the way over here. A lot of them go to the bigger cities. The immigrant community in this area are long-term residents.
So what happens when, I would imagine then you're talking about the status of your clients and they're seeking legal residency or to stop from being deported back to their home countries. Is that the case in the instances of your clients?
So the vast majority, I would say, of my cases are individuals or non-citizens that are seeking a benefit through the Office of Immigration, so USCIS, instead of individuals that are that I have to defend them from being removed from the United States. And so a lot of the cases that I've seen come through Kenosha Racine area are actually people that have been victimized, have been victims of a crime. There's a certain benefit called the non-immigrant status, where if you've been a victim of a crime and you cooperated with authorities, you can seek this benefit. And so I get a lot of cases from individuals that have been victims of crime. I also get a lot of cases from individuals or non-citizens that are married to a U.S. citizen or someone that has a green card and have been abused through the marriage. Or a child has been abused by a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident. And so this is very vulnerable immigrants that we represent. And it's interesting that, you know, a lot of them are eligible for this benefit, and they're the most vulnerable of our community. So we have good working relationships with the community and community members that we've seen in Kenosha that make the non-citizens aware of these type of benefits. And so you sometimes do, you know, the other big process that we help people is it's a family petition where a child is petitioning for a parent. And then there is those small, you know, sometimes there's a raid that happens, and so a lot of them get picked up and put in removal proceedings. And so one of the things that I would like to mention is that the most common way we get involved in a removal case where, you know, immigration is trying to deport a person is because that person was stopped through a traffic stop. So it's not really a serious crime, and that's why they're being put in removal proceedings. It's basically because the person doesn't have a license to drive. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin, they don't issue licenses to non-citizens. And so this person is driving, gets pulled over by a police officer, doesn't have a license, and somehow, you know, through that information, sometimes they go get fingerprinted at the station, and that information gets shared with immigration, and then immigration starts their investigation and realizes this person is here undocumented. So then they initiate removal proceedings.
Could you explain to us whether or not a law enforcement officer who might stop a driver without a license, whether they're obligated to report the status of a citizen that's driving without a license?
No, they are not obligated. A lot of counties, eventually, if you get more than one driving without a license, it becomes a criminal offense. And then sometimes you have to serve some jail time because you can't get a license. And so when you get booked into these county to a county correctional facility, that county, for the most part, is what shares that information immediately with ICE. You also have sometimes where they will share the because we have public information called CCAP, where you can be notified or anybody can access it and realize, you know, how many people have been, you know, what type of criminal proceedings are pending against a person in Wisconsin. Sometimes what immigration does is go through that and see the names and see, you know, if there's anyone that matches a name that they're looking on their list, but they're not obligated to share that information.
So it's more the ICE officers combing through court records in order to identify who might be in detention centers awaiting some minor violation regarding their license and traffic violations.
No, it's actually through their sharing of fingerprints.
Oh.
What you're booked into. Yeah. So another way they do it is through CCAP records, the online public access information of individuals that have. But the most common way is through the sharing of fingerprints when you're booked. And then also when you're booked, you share the information. They ask you, you know, where are you from? And so you say, well, I'm from Mexico or El Salvador, and they share that information with immigration, who then starts an investigation and at that time decides to issue what's called an ICE hold or ICE detainer. And then if they follow through, it's a different story. So if they do decide, if they issue an ICE detainer, they have 48 hours to go get you from the county correctional facility and take you to their detention centers, because there's only two detention centers in the state of Wisconsin.
And they're located, what, in Madison and Kenosha, right?
Dodge and Juneau County and Kenosha.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, what happens to an individual then who is removed from the county detention center and taken to the ICE detention center? What happens in a case like that with their family, and how much time does it take to be able to represent them properly and ease their concerns? I can imagine that's just such a harrowing experience.
It is. It's a very difficult experience. And a lot of times, a lot of these people are driving because they have to get to work and they have to drop off the kids, right? And a lot of them are the breadwinners of the home. So once, for the most part, once their family member gets detained and transferred to the detention center, there's two things that can happen. You can request that ICE issue a bond and see if they're interested in issuing a bond. Before the Trump administration, it was more common for ICE officers to decide to issue bonds, and they were very low bonds, like $1,500, and all the money had to be paid up front. Since the Trump administration, I've seen that they no longer issue bonds, even for cases where the person has been here for 10, 15, 20 years, no criminal record except traffic violations, and sometimes have very ill children at home that need them. And I've seen them now refuse to issue bonds when it was something that was very common for them to do before.
I wanted to just add something to that. I just noticed a PolitiFact story in the Milwaukee Journal recently that gave the truth-o-meter test to whether or not people who are released from those detention centers on bond show up for their hearings, because oftentimes the hearings can come maybe a year or two or maybe even 3 years after they had been detained. And there was a correction that actually the majority of people do indeed show up for their hearing. I think that's another misunderstanding of people in our community. As you've mentioned, people have grown roots in this community. They don't not show up or take off. They have too much at stake to lose if they don't. So in these instances now where you've seen this change in approach between the Obama administration and the Trump administration, I also understand that we have the largest number of children who are also now detained because their parents have been detained. Something San Francisco Chronicle recently reported, 14,000 children in this country who have been detained as well. What's your experience with that in our area of the country?
Yeah, so we actually, the closest Office of Refugee Resettlement, where these children are placed when they come in, is in Chicago. So a lot of the times, our experience in this community, like I said, most of the immigrants in Wisconsin are well-settled immigrants that have been here for a long time. You rarely see them. You rarely see the newcomers in this area. They usually go to big cities. But what they do, these children end up being sponsored by some of these community members here in the non-immigrant, the immigrant community here in Racine and Kenosha. And so I work with them is in helping them sponsor so that the child can be released in the custody of a family member or a very close friend. But what's happening is that sometimes a lot of these sponsors are afraid of sponsoring the child because they have to provide their immigration status to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And it used to be that everything was kept confidential. They were just trying to get the kids released to a safe home. But now they're trying to use some of that information to also use it as an enforcement. And so go after the sponsors. And so you see the immigrant community be more hesitant to allow the children to be released under their custody or provide their immigration status.
I would imagine as a result, we are traumatizing a whole generation of children then who have lost their parents and lost their family connections and are in some strange place, not knowing what's going to happen to them. That's just such a frightful humanitarian issue that we need to address, I believe. If you could tell us a little bit about some of the particular struggles with finding support and sponsors for people, where do you branch out in these communities then to try to get some support for situations such as that so that we don't have children who are completely cut off from the family and the friends that they've known?
Yeah, so my experience where I've usually reached out to is either nonprofits or the churches. The churches have been amazing in stepping up and trying to find community members that are U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents that can house some of the children so that a family member doesn't have to disclose their immigration status and doesn't fear that, you know, they'll come after them. So, yeah, I mean, the churches have been great allies in the past year and the church members in helping us connect with individuals that are willing to help and that we know that they can provide a stable home for some of these children.
Are there any particular churches that you might be able to share with us so that if people in our community were interested in helping on this issue, they would be able to approach somebody in one of those churches or organizations and find out more information?
Yeah, so we've worked with St. Mark. We also have a Lutheran church that's, sorry, it's escaping me. I can't think of the name right now. But it's, we have a couple Lutheran churches. We also have on the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, some of their churches we work through them. But a lot of times it's when we go and give out community presentations that, you know, people want invite us to go give out presentations. We start connecting with individuals that are willing to help and we gather their information. And when we have a situation, we'll reach out to them directly.
Great. I'm going to take just a few minutes here to welcome any new listeners to our show this morning. This is Community Matters on WGTD 91.1 FM on your radio dial. And if you just joined us, we're speaking this morning with Gabriela Parra, an immigration attorney in Milwaukee who represents a fair number of people in Racine and Kenosha on immigration matters as well. So thank you for joining us this morning. Maybe we can shift a little bit now, Gabriela, if we could. There has been a lot of talk, a lot of fear, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of news stories about the migrant caravan from Honduras that is seeking asylum eventually and walking through all of Central America, it seems like, to get to the United States to find some refuge. There have been all kinds of reports about how large this caravan might be. Most recently, people have been talking about 3,000 migrants who have left their country, many of them saying after receiving death threats. And also because of the dire poverty of, as you have mentioned, that they are in many cases living on per capita income of about $120 a month. What can you shed a light on for us about this caravan from your seat as an immigration lawyer in Milwaukee? What do you see happening here?
Yeah, so I think that there's one thing that needs to be said is that, you know, these individuals are non-citizens, are actually refugees, and they're escaping their home country because of violence, poverty. But also a lot of them are seeking asylum because they've suffered some type of past persecution or mistreatment by organized groups, by their own family members, and so they're seeking protection in the United States from that persecution are those either the government actors or the non-government actors that have been harming the non-citizens. And I think that, you know, I think there's a misunderstanding that it's mainly because they're being because of poverty. But in reality, I've worked at the border. I volunteer once a year, and I work at the Women and Children's Detention Center. And I will say, hearing every single story that I've heard and help them prep for what's called a credible fear interview, which is their first step to try to see if they can remain in the U.S., all these people have suffered tremendously. They've suffered a lot of trauma. They've been persecuted in their home country by, right now, basically gangs overpower the government. They rule that country, and they have no rules. And if you don't pay a quota, they will kill you. And so that is what they're running from, and I don't think people understand or are seeing that, the seriousness of what's happening in Honduras and in Central America with the organized crime and how the government is just not doing something about it.
Right. When you look at people who are seeking refugee asylum here, being a victim of crime, having death threats, having extreme gang violence in their home countries has been, without question, something that we would understand would drive somebody from their homeland. Somebody doesn't casually make that decision to leave where they were born, their family, all their friends, everything they've known, and leave all their possessions to come to an unknown. In the discussion about migration from these countries where there has been such corruption, there's been talk about MS-13, I believe it is. Can you tell us anything you might understand about the gang violence in that particular organization, for instance, that you would know that so many of us are clueless about?
Yeah, so, I mean, what's happening in these countries, and I think people don't understand, is that MS-13 has, and other, there's also MS-18, which is the big rival gangs in these countries. They've taken the form of being a government. So what that means is they're charging taxes to the citizens. They are get to decide if your business is going to be a place where you're going to store their weapons. They are targeting their children, and specifically like women, they become gang girlfriends, and they make them be their girlfriends, and they make them board their babies, and they're targeting children that are 6 years old to transport guns in a backpack, and you can't say no to these people. They're basically ruling these countries, and the minute you try to and when you try to say no, you don't want to take part of that, you start seeing family members being killed.
We have this caravan, as it's been called, of migrants coming to the United States. What kinds of stories, from your experience, are we likely to really hear? Is there any one example that sticks in your mind that you might be able to share with us from the time you've spent volunteering on the border?
Yes. So I have one particular case that really struck me, and I think that one of the things I want people to also understand is that, you know, when you've been victimized for so long, that's not something you just want to tell a stranger immediately. So, you know, it's not that they're going to be sharing these stories immediately with you. And I had this case, and, you know, it started with what appeared to be, you know, just a case where she was fleeing poverty. And as I got, you know, deeper into talking with her and I built my trust, eventually we got to the point where she disclosed that she had been targeted by MS-13, had to be their server for 2 years, was basically a prisoner in her own home, and she had to serve them, cook them, clean, and do any errand they wanted. And every time she tried to either run away or say, you know, I can't be doing this, you can't be in my house with your guns, they would point a gun to her 2-year-old and say, well, we're about to shoot your baby if you don't continue helping us. And so she did this for 2 years and eventually found the opportunity to escape and fled with her child to the United States and was detained. And so now she's at this detention center with her child, and here I am, a stranger, asking her to disclose all of this to an officer so that, you know, she's given the opportunity to fight a case here in the U.S. And she, you know, she had never talked to anyone about it. And so opening up all this trauma really had an impact on her. And it's hard because that's what they need to do. And then you don't have the resources to help her deal or go through that trauma with someone with therapy and that has the experience to do it. And so that has always really stuck with me on how unfair and this process really is for trauma victims.
Oh, what a horrific story. Is there any advocacy that's happening now to help seek some kind of trauma treatment for detainees in detention centers around the United States? It seems like that's a plausible humanitarian issue that might be able to get some traction somewhere if we had the right people advocating for that. Have you heard of any organizations or anybody seeking that?
I know that the place where I volunteer, which is Dilley, Texas, which has one of the family detention centers, they usually get or try to get social workers, therapists to volunteer 1 week. And so sometimes they're fortunate enough to have, like, social workers or therapists that volunteer that week, but that's not always the case. And so unfortunately that I know, there's just not enough resources to also get a therapist. Therapist for all of these, because you have to understand, I mean, I was prepping about, I mean, there's 100 people sometimes that needed preparations for their interviews that were up, that were coming, that were going to happen that week. And so I would see a day probably between 5 to 10 people.
Goodness.
Or 5 to 10 women and children a day. So I can't imagine having that many. I'm not sure how they would go about getting that many therapists and resources there, but there are weeks that, you know, social workers, therapists do volunteer their time for a whole week, and it's just, their help is tremendous. It's amazing the work they do when we do have that in the detention center.
Goodness. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think that deepens all of our understanding for what somebody might be going through as they reach our country's borders. It seems to me that we're concentrating so much on protectionism in the United States and nationalism in the United States. What are we doing, or what could be done in ways of policy to force some change in Central and South American governments to take responsibility for what's happening and to take their countries back?
I think that, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer, because, I mean, one of the things is that they definitely need to control organized crime that's happening. And the problem is that, you know, one of the things that we have to show to receive asylum when we're helping and advocating for a client to receive asylum is that we have to show that if it's not the government, if it's a non-government actor who's doing the persecution or the mistreatment, we have to show that the police are unable to protect you. And, you know, country conditions over the last years have supported how, in fact, it's the police that, you know, sometimes does the mistreatment. But it's also the police that take bribes from this, the organized crime groups. And so that's what stops them from, you know, doing their job. I mean, I've had clients where they've reported things to the police, where they've reported the threats, where even police officers have sometimes seen the violence that has occurred, but they're either sometimes too afraid, or they've taken bribes from the organized crime groups to do nothing. And so here we have law enforcement who's supposed to protect these individuals, and they don't. And so I think there definitely has to be a huge reform in their law enforcement, and also a lot of the times too is that they're not, they're arresting sometimes the perpetrators, but then they release them immediately the next day. Or they sometimes share the information where they're like, where someone makes a police report and then the law enforcement officer will directly contact the individual and say, hey, this person just came and complained about you. And so then that person goes and targets the family. And sometimes that leads to that perpetrator harming the individual that made the report or harming a family member of the individual. So now you have all that community knowing that this is happening and refusing now to go to police authorities. And not even refusing, but being too afraid to go to police authorities for protection. So they're left alone, and their best option is to flee the country.
It seems unfathomable, the lives that people have had to live and endure in those situations, far beyond our reaches and oftentimes beyond our understanding. So I appreciate your taking time to explain all of that to us. So for a listener here who might be in Racine or Kenosha or Milwaukee, are there certain things that they might be able to do or places that they might go to be more involved in immigration issues should they choose to do so?
Yes, I think that there's always nonprofit organizations like there's Voces de la Frontera that's a good group to try to go in and volunteer. There's always Catholic Charities has a program for immigrants, and so these are nonprofit organizations that are always in need of volunteers when they do their programs, and also to help disseminate this information. So once we train you, the community member who's not afraid, who has the status to advocate, who's legally in this country, begin to advocate for those that can. And also we train them to figure out, in case of an emergency, you can be a point of contact and help them navigate what should I do if my loved one gets detained. How can I help someone? And Voces de la Frontera and Catholic Charities have amazing resources and trainings that they offer and open to the public to help community members be advocate for our immigrant community in this area.
So that would be an avenue for me, for instance, or anyone who is listening, to be more direct help from somebody who might be waiting for a trial or who might be in fear of being separated from their children in order to help them out. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right.
That is correct.
We had talked previously about there being a couple of waves of ICE officers through Racine and Kenosha communities, particularly at the end of the summer. Are you dealing with a larger amount of number of people who have been detained at this time?
Yes. I mean, right now the problem with ICE not issuing any bonds is that they're sitting in detention. And the earliest sometimes you can get a court hearing to be in front of a judge who decides to decide whether they'll give you a bond or not can take up to 3 weeks. Three or 4 weeks, just to get a hearing to see if you're eligible for a bond and how much that bond is going to be. So where it used to be that we can just request it directly to the ICE officers, now they're sitting in detention 2 to 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, awaiting a court hearing to be in front of a judge. So now sometimes we have 3 or 4 detained cases going at the same time when easily they could have been released because, like I said, they have a lot of positive factors and they're not a flight risk. And, we have documents to show that. We have community members that write letters to show that. But unfortunately, right now, it feels like they have their orders is to detain people and then let the judge decide the bond.
Would it be fair to say that this is probably an unprecedented time in immigration matters in our area?
I think it is in the sense that, I mean, there's so many changes that are happening so drastically and rapidly that it's just really difficult to just I mean, I think in, among us immigration attorneys, we've talked about it, and it's so hard and difficult to see all these changes are negatively impacting our clients, and they're making it, I feel like they're making it tougher for people that are eligible to receive a benefit to get it. Instead of before, it felt like, you know, they will, you know, if you were eligible, then they would just look and process the application and then approved it. Right now, they're just putting so many barriers for our community that makes it difficult for them to eventually get some status in the U.S. And like I said, these are long-term community members. I mean, I have clients that have been community members from Kenosha Racine for well over 20, 30 years that have waited patiently for their turn. And now that it is their turn, they're putting all these barriers for them to eventually get some lawful status in the U.S., which is contradicting because they keep saying, like, if you wait in line or if you follow the laws, you can get lawful status. Well, they are following, in that sense, the law that's right now in applying and everything, and then they just have to jump through so many hoops to be able to get their status.
You know, when you talk about the benefits that they're due, could you just briefly describe what that is, what you mean when you say that?
Yeah, so there's some people that are eligible to apply for adjustment or their green card here in the U.S., in the United States. And so a lot of them are, for example, individuals that have children that turn 21, individuals that, for example, their child is in the military. And so you apply for these benefits in one of the things that if the person that's petitioning for you is a U.S. citizen, and there's some exceptions, but generally, if it's like a U.S. citizen child, and you apply for someone, for your parent that came in with the visa and overstayed their visa, they can apply for their adjustment of status or green card here in the U.S. And if they worked here unlawfully, that is not something that's counted against them. But now it make it seem like it's the worst thing that ever happened, and so that they ever done. And I mean, reality is that a lot of people have come into the U.S. They come in and to work. There's work, you know. There's a demand for jobs. They're meeting that demand, and so now they're trying to penalize them for it.
And in fact, aren't they usually paying Social Security taxes and other taxes that they never benefit from as well?
That is correct.
Right.
That is correct. And so that's why it wasn't a big issue. And now in the last year, I feel like now every time we go to these interviews, because we sometimes get an interview, it seems like they're trying to penalize them for something that has always been okay. And it cannot be counted against them. But, you know, there's so many barriers in that sense. And also the other thing is the big barriers are also the fact that they're taking a long time to process these applications. Right now I looked at a green card. We were looking at my partner and I looking at a green card application process. It says it ranges from 10 months to 24 months.
Oh, goodness.
For them to, yes. So something that used to take less than, I would say, six, seven months a couple years ago, now you have to wait two years to get your benefit.
Certainly puts a different definition to due process, doesn't it?
It does.
It does. Well, I so appreciate your taking so much time with us today to shed some light on a very serious issue for so many families and so many of our neighbors here in Racine and Kenosha. I thank you for all of your hard work on this issue, Gabriella, and I hope that you will have great success in the future with all of your clients and in continuing to educate us on some of these very difficult issues about immigration. Thank you so much today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Thank you.
Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more is available 24 hours a day on your desktop, laptop, smartphone, or radio. To access 24/7 Jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org, where you can listen live, online, 24 hours a day. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha-Racine area,